This is tape number 11. It's June 14th, 2000, Alfred.
Tape number 11, June 14th, Alfred.
2000. Okay. Most electrifying thing.
I went in there, and you never really forget a painting. See, you, like, we went to this doggy puppy class, and the people there said, all right, your name is Skondovich, she said, and he said, I will remember the name of your dog, you see, and all the other people here will become the names of their dogs, and that's quite true. And it's the same with painting. When you look at painting, they seem to hover in your consciousness, particularly if it's done in a particular way. When I think of a signature brush, I think of this fella. And here, on the wall to the bedroom was a triptych, and in three parts, and it was of an eagle, you see, and I thought, that's him. So then I was asked to get a coffee mug, and I opened up the cabinet that the grandma directed me to, and inside the doors had a painting, once again, of a distended, cut-up eagle, and it was this brush stroke. I mean, so then I thought, this is in the collection of Nelson Rockefeller. And I thought, God damn, America, I'm going to be rich, you see? And I said, then I thought, you better be cool now and denigrate the paintings, you see, and admire other things in the house. And I avoided talking about the paintings. And finally, we were chatting with his grandma, and she took me aside. And she said, I don't care what Jim does, but you be sure that he don't become a fry cook. If he becomes a fry cook, I'll kill the son of a bitch. I said, ma'am, grandma, I'll see that he won't do that. He was in business management at Claremont. He won't be a fry cook, I assure you.
Young fellow?
Yeah. About 26 then. You know, these are guys fresh out of college, beginning their careers, you know. There were another bunch of guys who weren't beginning in their careers and were, you know, sniffing around foundation money. Anyway, so I sort of gained the confidence of grandma. And I said, who painted these little things? They're so delightful. And she said, my grandpa did that, so that would place him, you know, at the turn. And that was Grandpa Vail, V-A-I-L. And he was an artist here. And I thought, now we approach the mother load. I said, is this all he did just in the house, you know? I guess he didn't really take it seriously. He said, no, we had him in the family barn. And I thought, the family barn. She said, yeah, that was a big structure. And I thought, man, I'm rich. And I said, well, how? I don't see a signature. I don't see the name Vail. And she said, well, he was kind of weird about that. But if you pick up a mirror and hold it and look back at the painting, you see where those flowers are? You'll see his name. And sure enough, Vail popped out of the goddamn bushes. I thought, man alive, America. I'm controlling myself, and I felt like screaming, shouting, you see. I thought, God, a triumph. I've discovered a painter, you know, in a premier collection. And I said, I wonder if I could visit the barn, you see. I enjoy the environments of artists, you know, even when they're just hobbyists, you know, to denigrate things. So, she said, I'm afraid, well, Jimmy Boy will take you up there, but there was that big fight and fire. I said, well, what fight and fire? He said, well, the Cooley family had a reunion of all the families. And they came from the east, they came from the south into California. And of course, the most famous Cooley was Cooley, who had a western band, you know. they would play these cowboy songs. A roll, a hop along, little doggy hop on. You know, this is when they wore those fanciful leather things and the hats, and they would, cowboys would sing, and they wore white hats, and they'd fight a guy in a black hat. And they never used to kiss the leading lady because this really frosts the kids. They go through, you know, sick in the children. You know what I mean, you see. And he was, anyway, the southern coolies and the northern coolies and coolies who came across the Great Divide all got in a fight. Believe it or not, I learned about America. The coolies who came across the divide were imprisoned and enslaved by Mormons, and they didn't like the treatment that they received. They never forget it. On another trip with J.R. Cooley, when we wrote a play and we were going to go out to East Hampton, where I spent the summer, and I knew some playwrights who would listen to it, or producers. We stopped by with his new bride, Beatrice, and we walked into the Mormon Tabernacle Temple, and I thought, God, how magnificent. And then Cooley absolutely started shouting, screaming, throwing cushions, and we had to take him out. The police came, and his forebears were kept in slavery by the Mormons. Believe that or not, but, you know. So I said, Jim, I'm kind of interested in looking at the barn. Maybe there's something left. It seems that 3,000 coolies arrived on this 40-acre spread, and there was fighting and a riot, and the barn was set afire, you see, very willfully. And the barn was also a place with adjunct buildings in which people lived, you see. So I insisted on going up there. I said, I really want to see where your great-grandpa worked. And we went up there, and sure enough, that barn, this is, 40 acres, did I say, in Southern California. This is, you know, expensive land, you know. You buy by the square foot, I think. But here's this desolate place, and I remember here were these ashes and fireweed in California had popped out in places, and all I could find was the burnt frame, the stretcher with just a glimmer of a canvas on it, you see, but showing nothing, just no longer than my hand and charred. That's all we could find. And I thought, well, let's go on to Houston, Texas. Did I call the Museum of Modern Art and tell them that if they approached the building with a hand mirror, they would find the name of the artist who did that, an unknown artist? I said, no, screw you, Rockefeller, you know. It'll cost you $1 million, and you won't get that information from me unless you come up with that kind of money. So then we arrived in Houston, Texas.
Yes. What I'd like to do
now. She was a young lady who was a beauty queen. Ursula Keller. I don't know what her married name is now. And she was attracted to the American soldiers, you know, but was very much a creature of the Nazi regime and, you know, a member of the, you know, the Nazi youth, and had been brainwashed by all of this. Ferguson worked in intelligence. He was a non-commissioned officer, and he worked in Heidelberg, which is really a soft station for these people. And he had an affair with Ursula, and then he left to marry his high school sweetheart. Family pressure was used in all of this. But then Ursula was a wild one anyway, and he was glad to get out of that. He arrives in New a studio. And then Ursula turns up and Ferguson departs. So then I had an involvement with her.
You dated her for a while?
Yeah, we were living together, you know. And I felt that Elliot was really rude and nasty to her, you know. I could sympathize with someone, even though we were kind of enemies, you know, with her situation. See, she loved this guy, and so we became involved. But she was always getting involved with all sorts of people. Her attitude towards me, she loved me very much, said she. But when I didn't want to see her anymore, she was just furious. She was possessive. No matter how many men she was having relationships with, none of them could be released or go anywhere. But mine was a special case because she was brought up to regard Jews as subhuman and to be rounded up and killed. See, and here she says that she's in love with me, a Jew, in defiance of, you know, the political regime that had, and I'm telling her, and there's no way that I could tell her to get lost. It's impossible that she's made this enormous sacrifice, has climbed across a chasm, you see, and to be treated this way by, you know, by an Untermensch or a subhuman that she wishes to elevate, you see. And that's all I want to say about it. We were both creatures of a goddamn war.
And she turned out to be quite destructive. I mean, she would act on her impulses.
She would, yeah. And so would I, you know. I thought, my God, we are like souls, but she doesn't have anything, she'll leave.
But you weren't aiming yours at her.
No.
Yeah, but she was definitely trying to harm you.
She suffered from peritonitis, just as my cat has diabetes. I've become an expert on it. She suffered from peritonitis. And I remember not being able to drive. When you live in the city, you don't learn to drive, you know. I remember at that time a fellow was acquitted as being an accessory in a bank robbery because the prosecutor accused him of driving the car. He said, I was born in New York City on Mott Street, and I tell you, I never drove a car in my life, and he got off. It was true. The defense made an issue of that, and he walked out. So I drove these little two-horse little milk carts on a farm, you know, and cars, no. So one night I had to take her. She had one of these attacks. She had to go into a hospital. And there was this old car, which was reminiscent of the old movies with these checkerboard panels. And I had to drive her out to some goddamn place where there was a hospital that where she'd already compiled a record, you know, x-ray with an internist there. And I'd never driven in my life, and also this horrible vehicle, you couldn't get into second gear. Here we are on the freeway, the first time I've ever driven, and blessedly the police came along, which is a risky matter for me. Although I thought, this is American, they don't ask you silly things about where you're from and, you know, identify yourself. You never, the documentation is, it seems to be voluntary. And I said to the policeman, I said, I got a woman here who's sick, take a look at her. And I can't drive, and this isn't my vehicle, and I got to get her to a hospital. And please have somebody. He says, no, you drive the car, and we'll have an escort for you. I'll be behind you, and another officer will precede you coming off the ramp. Ramp, you know, I don't know, fucking ramps or anything. So anyway, he said, you do the best you can. And he says, you should drive this in third gear. I said, I can't get it out of second. Meanwhile, Ursula comes to life, believe it or not, has the boys she goes back in the car and collapses, and I have this nightmare drive. And the cop says, you did very well, but we don't want to catch you driving this car, you see. And there are all sorts of perinatal attacks that I remember, you know, of that poor lady. She would be near death in these.
They operate things like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
No wonder she was a bitch. I mean, she was in pain. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, in addition to her upbringing.
Yeah. I thought, here she is from a foreign country, and this guy's turned his back on her. And I had great sympathy with her, you know. I thought, and then when Ferguson's friend, Hopkins, kind of kicking her around, I didn't like that either. So that it's strange that I really embraced this German girl, primarily because of these things. Also, it's convenient when someone arrives in your house, she's there with her baggage. I mean, what the hell? You know, you're the wooing and all this, and courting and all this stuff, you know, and baguettes of bread and flowers and wine. She's here, you see, what the hell? So but I'm somewhat, I'm serving my hormones, and I'm doing, you know, this is a bit of all right for me, you know. But we never had a relationship where she donned her clothing and I could do, it never reached that point. She was always too nervous and uptight and out the window and a fire escape.
You mean doffed her clothing?
Doffed her clothing, I'm sorry, yeah. And to, you know, settle into a pose. Maybe I learned from emotions, you know, emotions to be the model and all that, but I never got a successful painting out of her. But it wasn't all bad. It was certainly very interesting for me, you know, and that's really all there is to that, you know, to that woman. I want to go to the house of Marcel Duchamp because it ends with Ursula. Marcel Duchamp lived on 14th Street. And this is a little kind of, I'd call it a brownstone, but it isn't really. You know, a brownstone has a dignified staircase and a balustrade, you know, where the neighbors would sit and spit pumpkin seeds out on the sidewalk. No, this was in an area that was really coded for commerce. There's Union Square with its shops. I forget the names of them, but they were quite famous for bargains and stuff like that. There was a little tavern and eating place primarily that was Russian. It was called the Bear Inn. And there was a doorman, which is kind of rare in that part of New York. We were on 14th Street. And the doorman was a Russian Cossack, fully regaled in a uniform and a Cossack hat. And it was a very frightening aspect. I never went into the Bear Inn. You know, people would turn up in Rolls Royces and stuff, and their chauffeurs would come back for them. There's no place to park. Of course, 14th Street did have a famous restaurant, and that would be Lu Chow's, which goes back to the turn of the century, when once upon a time 14th Street would be like 42nd Street now. But anyway, Duchamp lived in this plain house, and it was a very quiet house, and I had relationships with the foreign painters who came to New York, because they were born over there, and they wanted to go back. And I was born over there, but I didn't want to go back, you see. So there was this discourse of visas and stuff like that. Special passports, people in trouble, where people can live and live quietly because of an experience someone has had in Europe, you know, in a concentration camp. And anyway, Marcel Duchamp, who showed, I think, in 1906 at the Armory with New Descending Staircase, had elected to live in New York. He played chess constantly, and I can't play chess. I can play checkers, but he just scoffed at the idea of playing checkers. And the house had a museum-like quality, except that museums, there's something dead, or there's a mausoleum quality to a museum in those days. Now we have museum directors who claim that they're as creative as artists, that the success of a show is, you know, their taste and all this stuff, you know. The Metropolitan Museum guys who spurned our work have come forth with people like that, you know. We are more important than the artists when we bring these assemblies together, then the sparks fly, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, everything was altered in the home of Duchamp. He would change things. Everything would fascinate him. He would sit in contemplation, and the act of playing chess, where there's an occasional move, a game might take hours or days. The air coming out of the sleeve of his shirt was fascinating to him, because how this could be incorporated into art. The artist Cornell went there, and he began the construction of things, you see. These little assemblages, yeah. This is all inspired by Duchamp, you know, like a visit to his house by Cornell was what changed his life. And interesting people would turn up. I would come with messages from Stanley William Hayter, who wanted to know when he was going to go back, because he was going to go back to Paris. And
is that how you met Duchamp? With the message?
Yeah.
He
yeah.
sent you there to the house?
Yeah, yeah. When are you going back? I'm going back, and you can stay at my place in Paris. Conversations are like that. And also, the studio was not vandalized in any way by Germans, you know, said Stanley William Hayter. And his answer to this would be long games of chess. Let him come by and play chess. And a strange man who was cheerful, but kind of like an older, trusted bank clerk. Not the CEO or vice president, but, you know, a trusty fellow. And there were exhibits in his house. Things were changed into exhibits. You know, sometimes I'd run an errand, and if I was with a friend, I'd say, go in and tell him I got something for him. And I'd go up the fire escape and dangle my legs off the roof, which was a risky business because there were police in Union Square, but they never bothered me. And it seemed, and he wondered, why did you do that? I said, because it's very Chagall-esque. There's the Russian Bear restaurant, and here I am up there. Don't you see it that way, you know? And however, he thought I should dance up there. I said, no, I won't do that, you know, you see. So, but one day there was a guy there, and a young fellow, and he seemed bored with the whole ball of wax. And he was younger than me by a couple of years. And his mother was, I can't think of her name. I think it was, she had the nickname of Squeaky or Bubbles, because she was a very optimistic lady, and she was the wife of the brother of Henri Matisse. And the brother, I think his name was Pierre, and Pierre opened a gallery in New York. The family took control of the paintings, and it was his joy to walk around 57th Street, head for the Oak Room of the plaza.
Son.
Son of Pierre. The Pierre Senior would dress like his legendary brother in an artist's smock.
Okay.
You see,
yeah.
In New York in the 50s, you see. And this was his son, Peter Matisse. And anyway, Bubbles or Squeaky, or I'll think of a name, maybe. I don't know where I can find it, decided that she really liked Marcel, and that Pierre was a real bore, and an embarrassment of wandering around that way. It never embarrassed him because it just kind of authenticated the work, you know. They said, this is the brother of the great painter, so this is the real thing, and the price will be the real thing, you know, don't dicker around here, you're offending artistic sensibilities, why become famous for that, you know. And he would dress in this Provençal garb, did. Well, anyway, his wife was there, was fed up with all this tomfoolery, with little Peter, and she would laugh and sing, and good times were had by all when she was there. And anyway, the young fellow said, who are you? I said, I'm Alfred Skondovich. I'm a painter from England, you know. I didn't want to burden him with the Hoffman School and all this Tommy Rot. And he said, I'm going to, why don't you come with me to Los Angeles tonight? We'll be there in the morning. I said, you have an airplane or something? He says, no. He says, I've got, he had some fast vehicle, and it seems that he and another bunch of rich young dudes would speed across the country, reaching Los Angeles within 24 hours. In their glove compartment, Peter Matisse explained to me, they had $100 bills, and they went on a prescribed route. They'd alert the cops to let them through, but if a policeman stopped them, they give him $100, and away they'd go. And they'd be floating along on dexedrine and stuff like that. And I was another girl who knew Ursula and was, and I explained my position with Ursula, that I just wanted to get away from her. I think she was dangerous and crazy. I understand her. I love her, but my God, I think she's going to kill everybody. And, you know, and her name was Susan Davis. The others nicknamed her UC, and years later, I thought, this is a fine woman with an honest face, a plain face. And not only that, she's poor because she has a little car. I remember there's one young lady at the Hoffman School, Phyllis Jampolsky. I think I told you about this before. But Phyllis, I thought, was dreadfully rich and decadent because she was driving a huge Plymouth. That's how naive I was. And of course, the little car owned by UC, which stood for Union Carbide, was a Porsche. And she would engage in these races. So the next thing I know, as you know, as a result of going to Duchamp's house, is I'm in one of these headlong flights along the country, and traveling at dawn at 120 miles per hour, and which was very exciting.
How far did you get? To L.A.?
Yeah, of course. But not just to L.A., but to the beach at Santa Monica. This was the beach name for the film comedian who came up here and died. Will Jones. Is that the name?
Will Jones?
No. The movie star.
Will Rogers.
Will Rogers. We all wind up at Will Rogers Beach. And young people would arrive on that beach. We'd arrive within 30 minutes. The last contestant would come in this insane race, you know. Sometimes someone would get killed, and this was an excuse to drink champagne all night long, you see. I don't know who got killed. I met a young guy, and he said, I'm interested in art. And I thought, one of the children from the land of Beulah is interested in art. And I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, I... He said, do you know what a Monticelli looks like? I says, yes, I do. He says, you do? I says, yes. And he said, could you recognize one without getting close to it? Could you look at it through your peripheral vision and say, that's a Monticelli? I says, yeah, I think I could, yes. If the lighting was right. And he said, all right, come with me tomorrow. And we went to this house up in the hills where J.R. Cooley in Days of Yore bought the fire engine red Cadillac. And we're in the house of the movie actors who had expired, and the estate was put to auction. He said, just walk in there, and all this is displayed in the living room. The Monticelli is on the right. I'll see you in the kitchen. Now, I'll look at it. He said, no, I won't look at it. You look at it, and give me the high sign in the kitchen. So anyway, one of the race drivers takes me up there. I'll tell you what his name is in a moment. And I walk through the living room. I didn't break my pace. I walked slowly. And I thought, my God, that's the Monticelli. Unbelievable. I mean, the rest of the paintings were like shit. You know, some director, interior decorator put this together, you know, in this flaky way. But that, I said, yeah, that's a Monticelli. So he took me back to the beach and bought me an ice cream soda. There's a little stand, and we all went over to the beach. And he disappeared. He comes back with the painting. He says, I bought it for $500. He says, now what do I do with it? I said, well, it's Monticello. You can enjoy it for the rest of your life.
Monticello or Celli?
Monticello. Or Monticelli, I'm not quite sure. And I said, I know someone very interested in that. He'll give you $50,000 for it. He says, really, who is that? I said, it's Nodler in New York, Zurich. He said, well, how the hell? I said, you call him and they'll jack you in to wherever he is. Just tell him you have a Monticelli. Monticelli. So there was, beside the place where you can buy sodas on the sidewalk across from that beach, there was an open telephone booth. And if you looked up on the bluffs, you see the bluffs where, looking north, you would see the beaches of Malibu and the bluffs where Charlie Chaplin and all those people played around with Getty and the Getty Mansion, which is now a museum, down a ways. And we're in this open phone booth, and I called the gallery. And they said, you have a Monticelli? And they jacked us through to this voice in Switzerland, the guru of art dealers. He says, what size is it? And I said, it appears to be 20 by 25. He said, is it on wood? I said, yes, it's on wood. He said, oh, I don't have a manza in 20 minuten. I said, but we're in Santa Monica. He said, I know where you are. You're near the bluffs where we all had to run from the police after the Charlie Chaplin was a fool who stuck around and got arrested. I know where that is. And he said, I'll have a man do in 20 minutes with a check for you. And he doesn't know anything about painting, so don't take the painting out of the paper bag. So a guy comes along and he takes the bag, sort of glimpses in there. He says, yeah, there's a painting in here. I said, yeah, and it's a Monticelli. And he gives this guy a check for $50,000. And that was the beginning of the art career of Fagan, Fagan Galleries. He was a stockbroker.
F-A-G-A-N.
Fagan. Fagan Galleries in New York. Isao Noguchi designed his gallery in New York, which I never went to. He had water that would cascade around the gallery, I'm told, but I never went to it. And then his hometown was Chicago, and he built a gallery there. Like 5,000 other people, I'm sure he read a book on Emil Nolde by an outfit called Abrams Publications. They would do these short, concise books, 8.5 by 11 books with good reproductions and good text. And the Abrams book on Emil Nolde concerned paintings and letters that he wrote to his dealer. Vast contradiction exists in there's a sensitivity in the paintings of Nolde. But he was regarded as degenerate and was ordered into exile by Hitler. And Nolde would constantly write to the Führer saying, "I'm an honest German. I struck a Jew over the head when I was 16 and threw rocks in this Jewish drugstore. So how can you do this to me, one of your faithful Nazi?" But the Führer ordered him into exile. I forget the name place. I think it was the Weddersee, some place on the Baltic Sea. Anyway, when you look at the letters in Abrams' book, and thousands of people did, there was a letter in which Nolde decries the conditions under which he lived, and that no money is coming into him. And how could he, you know, would his dealer somehow get him into a good light with the Führer? He said, "Yesterday, it rained right into my living room. Rain came through the roof. But turning the page, the next letter written the following day doesn't make this report of water coming in through the roof." He said, "It's raining out there. God, it's so miserable here," said Nolde. "But no rain was coming through the roof." Fagan flew to Wettersley and climbed up on the roof and found Head of Christ. He had stop the leak with this friggin' painting. And how can I call him a bastard, but he paid me with what was that, an ice cream soda, said I. And he salvages that great painting. I think when Emil Nolde had second thoughts about where his mind was going. And he brought that back, and he really started an exploration of German expressionists, you see, getting in on the bow wave of the excitement that we caused. But these were painters who were famous and known. So he started this kind of subtide. And anyway, that was Fagan. He did
subtitle. What do you mean?
Subtide.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
subtitle.
A minor ebb flow or what have you.
Okay.
He came back to America, and amazingly, He became an expert on Nolde, did Fagan. I can't think of his first name. He learned that there were paintings of Nolde in the museum in I think Providence, Rhode Island. And he went up there and examined the painting. There was a painting by Nolde, and it was on the wall, and it said in the collection of the artist. So he went to the curator and said, "How can this be in the collection of the artist when the artist is dead? I collect these paintings, I'd like to buy it." They said, "No, his wife still lives, and she lives here in America." So he went to see her. She's an old lady. Oh God, what the hell is this? They left some electrodes in me.
Yep, they did.
Oh.
Turn it off.
Anyway, so he says, "Mrs. Nolde lives here." They said, "Yes." So he goes over there and buys that painting off of her for about $7,500.
Which painting?
It, the painting of Nolde's in the museum in Providence.
Okay,
and that was on a religious theme. He bought that off of her.
How'd you get to the museum in Providence?
In Providence?
Is that what you just said?
Yeah, in Providence. He read that there's a painting.
Oh, it was there but belonged to her.
Yeah, he discovered that, and he kind of conned her out of it.
What did he do with the painting he found in the roof? Did he keep that as though it was his property?
He kept it, yeah. He kept it.
How did you hear about all this?
No, just scuttlebutt, but
okay.
I'm sure that's what happened. I'm sure that's something he would do. The guy was a great broker. He was taught.
Positive, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he would look into things, and so he did in art, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's kind of pissed at me for all that I did, and all that he didn't do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel to hell with him. But those were really happy days. We.
So when would this have happened? So you rode across country at top speed, but that was before you moved out to California?
Oh, yeah. We'd be there, and then we'd go on back.
Yeah. Did you do it more than once?
I did it twice, and that was enough for me. That was enough for me. Nothing is as elegant as a little Porsche chugging along, you know. But nothing is unelegant as a Porsche to sideswipe a concrete pillow and looks like bloody hell with all your limbs exposed. And I tell you, those early Porsches are never had any, even with the canvas awning up, you never got shelter from the storm. You'd be soaked from the waist up or the waist down. A strange vehicle that I never grew to love. Paris now.
Okay.
With Giacometti.
Okay, so what year is this roughly? Is this when you go over with Patty?
No. This is when I finally was legalized in America, had a green card, and received a British passport.
1959
or 60? This was 59 when I received my green card and my British passport from the consulate in New York. And then I thought I'd go home, see my family, and then see what's going on in Paris. And I enrolled at the Le Grand Chaumont, which is in the Montparnasse district of Paris. Also had a letter of introduction to Samuel Beckett from Eve Daniel of the French National Theatre, a cultural mission in America in New York, New York. I've always admired the work of Giacometti, you know. There's another quality about them, kind of a metaphysical quality that comes in this sculpture. And I just thought I want to see where a guy like this works. At the Grand Chaumont, there was a guy who came up from Lyon who said, "I know him, and I'll take you to see him." So he says he drinks at the Select or Rotana. I was telling you about this, and I don't know which restaurant we'll have to. So anyway, he leads me over there to the chagrin of my waiter, who stood in the middle of this broad avenue, you see, with his hands on his hips, as though this is betrayal, disloyalty.
Okay, just because for the tape, a little bit about what happened, I mean, how they adopt you, waiters.
When you go into a coffee shop in Paris, if you go once or twice, you're in and out of there. But if you go there, say, a half a dozen times, you'll come under the command of a waiter. He recognizes you, he wants to know all about you, and he makes it clear that your life is now in his hands. You tell him your true age, what your sexual orientation is, what you do, and so on and so forth. And he will solve all of your problems, where to do laundry, and so on and so forth. And they invest in you, and your coffee there seems very expensive, but it's really a rental on a table. So if you remember that, remember that your coffee, you've paid rent on something, and there you is, and might be, you know, this is not true in Starbucks where you drink and you get the hell out of there, you know, there's all that action. And the coffee shops are immediately recognizable because of the paintings of Manet. But there are other artists, Charbonneau, Meissonier, you sit down in this environment, it seems totally familiar because of these paintings that you've seen waiting for dental work. You've seen these things, you've been inundated with them from when you were a child. But this is true about the way this being so possessive. Anyway, I was led over the road, and we waited for Giacometti, and he arrived, and he was this fidgety, craggy, skinned man, and he kept fiddling with his fingers with what appeared to be peanuts, but which were actually little bits of clay. And he would discard some of these peanuts and put them in the ashtray. Like an idiot, I should have picked them up, because these would be the heads of these wire sculpture that he was working on at that time. Anyway, we decided that we'd walk from the Café Select or Rotonde, we'd walk to the corner where there's a newsstand and go up this angled street, and there we would be in what were a row of stables and a cobbled street. And there are businesses in Paris that still use horses. Not the way you think. Christian Dior delivers things in an elegant little black van pulled by a horse, a white Arabian. And florists sometimes use a horse. Very expensive proposition. And also, it had just rained, and the sun had come out, and the effect of the light rain and the sun was you were drenched in the aroma of horse